It's the Matt Bubala Show here on Radio 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for hanging out with us. Morning, Roger Badish.
Well, good morning, Matt Bubala.
Hold on. An important word now from Patty Vasquez.
The Hornets are buzzing into the United Center to battle the Bulls. Watch the action tonight at 7 on WGN-TV Sports.
This is a new thing we're doing where we're just going to do spots for each other's shows.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or catch up on the ones that we missed.
Wait till you hear Patty at the 4:30 half hour. Doing
tired. Yeah, just hand those over here. That works out very well.
How are you, Miss Patricia?
I'm well.
Were you Patricia when you were growing up, when you were in trouble?
Patricia. Patricia.
Is that when you were in trouble or just was your mom? Because my mom always called me Matthew.
Patricia is when my mom has really taken a turn for.
And otherwise, it was just Patty?
Patty. But my mom, I was Patsy, actually, after Patsy Cline.
Mm-hmm.
My dad called me. You know how, you'll know how long someone's known me if they still call me Patsy. It's pre Little League baseball.
Oh, so when you were in really
up until I was nine,
even the kids in the neighborhood would call me Patsy.
God, so bad.
And you didn't like it at the time?
I didn't like it. I didn't like it when I played Little League baseball. That was when they started making fun of me for that name. So I know the boys.
Bastards.
I was the only girl on the team. And
that'll happen.
Fatsy Patsy. Although Patty, Fatty Patty's not much better, but for some reason I was able to tolerate it a little bit more.
It's funny. So your name, my sister Angie, was named after Angie Dickinson.
Oh, really?
Because my dad was all into Angie Dickinson, which is like so weird to me that like
it's a little creepy.
Yes,
it's a little bit. Uh huh.
Like, how did my mom go along with that?
I don't know. But Patsy Cline, I mean, was a legendary singer who died tragically. So I think my dad felt like it was an homage. Yeah.
At least that's okay.
Were you Maddie? Anyone ever call you Maddie?
No. Okay, no.
Good.
I was Matt.
I'm going to call you Maddie now.
My mom always called me Matthew. Mm-hmm. Actually, my buddy Tim Mahoney, one of the baseball coaches, always calls me Maddie. But that's like in the last 5 years.
Right.
So never when I was in college, I was Boobs because of the last name Bubala.
Boobs?
Yeah. Boobs!
Me too, oddly enough.
Yeah, because of your last name.
Yeah, well.
Nobody ever called you Boobs, actually.
They would call me Bouncing. My last name is, I have a different last name that goes well with the word Bouncing, so. We'll talk about it off the air. I don't use my real last name.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's my dad's last name.
Vasquez is not the last name you grew up with?
It's my mother's last name.
Oh, so it's like
Patty,
a stage name?
Yeah, Patty Vasquez sounds Irish and Mexican. See what I did there? And it's also very traditional to use your mother's last name. Like a lot
as
of,
a stage name?
That's why we have so many last names. We say De Vasquez, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you keep all the names.
Oh, interesting. All right, so talk to me about this for a second.
Yes.
There is a... Carrie Fisher has been talking about how she had to lose 35 pounds for Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Hamill came out and said he lost 50 pounds for Star Wars.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if that was forced upon him or if he was just like, crap, if I'm going to do this again, I got to get in shape.
So she's saying they forced her. We speculate that he might have done that willingly.
Well, we don't know. I mean, she said she's made comments about how it's the same old thing. It's about what you look like, not who you are.
Okay.
And so she's kind of been a little edgy about it.
Okay.
And Mark Hamill just said, I'm basically, for the last couple of years, I'm on the, if you like it, you don't get to eat a diet. He lost 50 pounds. I don't know what he looks like. We haven't seen any footage of him in the movie because they're kind of hiding
that.
No,
isn't that wild?
So we have no idea what's going on there. But I thought, you know, it's interesting, the whole women in media and women in, you know, the pressure to look great. But on this, So I need you to straighten me out on this.
Sure. No, she's iconic. Look, Princess Leia even in the original film, right? She's got that.
She said they made her lose 10 pounds just to get the role of Princess Leia in the first film.
Well, and there often is pressure to for women to lose weight. I mean, we mentioned Margaret Cho earlier, who had her own series, and the network had told her she needed to lose weight. I think that that's changed a little bit as far as television goes. You can see a wide range of sizes. You see Amy Schumer posing for Annie Leibovitz, you know, and I know people are talking about that a lot too.
But that's interesting. Because I bet Amy Schumer in the past mm-hmm. got a lot of heat about when she had her show when she wasn't Amy Schumer yet,
right.
When she was trying to become Amy Schumer. I would bet that they were like, well, if you lose this, if you do that. I bet that she heard that a lot. And now she's Amy Schumer, so she can say, I am who I am.
Exactly.
And she's really done that.
Well, the reason we get into comedy isn't to be a model, right? I was told by the Ford talent agency here in Chicago, my agent said, you know, you're adorable. If you'd lose 15 pounds, I could get you a lot more work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I guess I'm not going to, you know, it was commercial work or auditioning. I think it happens more subtly. I mean, like, I'm not sure what it's like when you get to that level. And believe me, if I'm told things, I will let people know the sort of pressures that are put on me. I'll be very vocal about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it happens more. You just don't get the work. I don't know that they come out and say it's because you're heavier.
Right.
You know, I think that Melissa McCarthy has changed that a lot. I think, again, I think Amy Schumer has broken down a few of those doors. But I also think it would come down for me. Like, I'm just self-conscious of the way I look. There are certain things I don't like about myself.
Sure.
The reason I take so many selfies is I've gotten good at the right angles, too.
Right.
You know, you sort of become your own worst critic as well. But yeah, when it comes to Princess Leia, I mean, we have an expectation. It's a visual art.
It is kind of.
And it's visual consumption too.
And I'm trying to think about, like, I was thinking about the movies tonight, and you know, there's one X-Wing fighter in the first movie who's overweight, but in Jabba the Hutt, of course, but and nobody else. But but it's also sort of like, well, if I could see them being like, well, here's the thing. They've been struggling. So
right.
It's not like they're, you know, I don't know. I don't know how they.
I'm not sure where she is now in the character's arc. But
yeah,
is she a general, I think? Or
I've just read that. I'm trying to avoid everything about
it.
I'm sorry. I read it. So I'm like, I didn't want to know that.
I mean, and look, whatever. Generals in real life come in all shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they're out there still, you know, swinging a lightsaber. But I think, too, but Carrie Fisher's interesting because she's also very open about how she's treated her own body with whether it's drinking or drugs.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, and time takes a toll. So, you know, what kind of what can you expect of yourself when you reach a certain age and you've lived a certain kind of lifestyle?
Yeah.
You know,
well, it's, you know, I guess if they did ask Mark Hamill and tell him too, then I think it's fine. If they're only telling the women, I'm sorry, you've got to be this or this. Mm-hmm. And Mark Hamill will accept that you've aged and this is who you become, then it's unfair.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean, here's my take on show business. It's never fair. They don't. I mean, the thing is, like, they don't owe you anything. Like, they kind of make the rules. I mean, this is how they know money is made. It sucks. Show business is not easy. I've told comics this for dozens of years. I mean, for over 20 years, the club people always complain about the clubs that won't book them. You know, it's because they don't like this or that. And like, they don't owe you anything. You know, they don't owe Carrie Fisher anything. Unfortunately, it's not. I know it sounds horrible, but this is not a fair business.
They don't. However, it is unfair in that, I mean, yeah, it's
their
business.
Better. It doesn't mean we can't hope for better.
But here's the thing. It's like, you know, Amy Schumer has broken a mold then. You know what I mean?
Because yes, she absolutely has.
And Amy Schumer, I think, is different from Melissa McCarthy because, Melissa McCarthy, Chris Farley, there's certain, like, you can't be in between. You either have to be heavy and funny or thin and pretty.
Right.
You know what? You can't
and
be
Amy's
sort
kind of
a
medium.
Yeah, I could lose 10 or 15 pounds.
Right.
Well, that doesn't cut it.
Right.
Either, you know, you're this or you're that. And
I agree.
And like that in between, they'll just.
I'm a right down the middle of the road medium. And I think Amy Schumer is as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, mediums. I always laugh when they say plus size models and it's like a size 10. You're like, that's not a plus size model.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, that's not even, it's barely large. Not even. Yeah.
Well, when it's comparing to zeros, then it's.
Yeah, exactly. Whoop, whoop. I know. And that's the thing. I've told this story about shopping at a store called It's a Wrap in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
And the costume designers, the costumers in Hollywood actually many times cut the tags out of wardrobe so that their performers or the stars don't know what size they have to wear.
Really?
Or they'll sew in like a zero or a two so that they can make them, they don't have to be yelled at or this isn't my size. The wardrobers just want them to put the clothes. They know what fits their performer. But in order to sort of placate them, it's a whole game. It's a whole mind game out there. It's not easy. It's not, you know, and just the chance that you even get through, break through all that noise. Like Carrie Fisher is great at Princess Leia. I mean, I loved her and you know, the unfortunate fact is that our image of her was also that petite sort of, you know, she was small. I mean, visually, look at the way she looks.
She was
on
very
screen.
Tiny.
She was very tiny. And there was something kind of tough and formidable about her, even though she was small.
The funny thing about them telling her she had to lose 10 pounds for the role. Now, if the 10 pounds loss is what we then saw in the film, it's funny to me because she's covered up completely in that first film. I mean, you see her in the goofy white gown and the bun hair. If she gained 10 more pounds, I don't think you'd even know.
You wouldn't. Right. And to us, we would. We'll never know that.
Yeah.
You know,
plus doesn't movies. They say the camera adds 10 pounds to you.
Right.
I believe that. I feel like when you take pictures, like, ooh, do I really look like that?
Yeah, I mean, like even I've seen myself on the set, and it's weird. Like, I feel like my eyes look smaller, my cheeks look puffier than they even look in my pictures.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part of this is we wish that they didn't perpetuate these images of women where girls then feel like I have to aspire to that.
Right.
It's this vicious circle of.
Do you think that men face it in any way, shape, or form?
I would think
on the
so.
Show that you're trying to produce, do you think if they're asking you to do things, they would ask the same thing of other people?
Which
because I imagine certain, I guess it depends on what you're casting, but like if John Stamos or who is
Jerry O'Connell,
if he had gained 10 pounds, I mean, like, that's not who we're hiring, Jerry O'Connell. We want Jerry O'Connell that we all know.
What's interesting about that is that when I met him, I was surprised at how skinny he was. I think that because it is their profession, so many of them in Hollywood maintain a lifestyle. I know so many people who won't eat sugar. They take all these pills. They have a medical professional that makes sure that they're balanced in all these different ways. They're, you know, consuming the right amount of protein. I mean,
because
really,
that's their life. That's their livelihood.
That's their profession. It's their livelihood. Jerry O'Connell maintains, you know, a certain body type so that he can continue to be considered for roles.
And he was a chunky little kid, as you remember from Stand By Me.
He was. And it was funny, he was telling a story about his kids, a classmate of theirs was being picked on for being chubby. And like, it's weird because, like, yes, he, for us as mm-hmm. kids, he was sort of like this, we felt bad for him because mm-hmm. he was this chubby kid in Stand By Me. Mm-hmm. And it's weird for him as an adult that he now kind of perpetuates that really skinny, angular look, you know?
But that's required for his job.
I have to show you a picture. He's really quite thin. Yeah.
And are you surprised sometimes because he looks healthy mm-hmm. when you see him when you have the picture of him or whatever? Yeah. He looks like a healthy person he's really in shape.
Right.
But you're like, God, he's really skinny.
He's very skinny.
And I think that lends a little bit to what Roger's saying is like to mm-hmm. look healthy, you sometimes maybe, you know, do have to kind of be ridiculously skinny, right?
Yeah. I think not to look healthy, but to be
on camera like what seems like standard, like mm-hmm. on TV, we don't see him as, oh, my God, he's lost too much weight. It's rare. You see a Laura Flynn Boyle where you're like, that's too much.
Yeah, even on camera, I always thought she looked very skinny. Calista Flockhart, you know, I always thought was incredibly thin on television. Yeah, it's almost like to the extreme. Yeah.
I think where it's evident for me, and I don't know why it's like this, but in a TV show or a movie, actresses and even actors look... I hate to use the word normal, but we're not sitting there watching the movie and going, oh, my God, they look so thin and skinny. Mm-mm. But when they're on a talk show, mm-hmm. and I know it's still TV, but maybe it's because of the high def or whatever, but they really look skinny. They don't look like they do on a TV show or in a movie.
See, it's interesting. I rarely ever see anybody on TV and go, wow, they look thinner than I imagined.
I don't know if you can see, like, I mean, like, here's a picture of Jerry O'Connell on Instagram. You can see that his waist is really narrow.
But it looks to me like, wow, that dude's normal. In shape. It doesn't look like, oh, boy, he's too skinny.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be concerned for his health. I mean, he's cut. Like,
and his face is full. It's not like it's gaunt.
He's got dimples.
He's got good cheeks.
He's got very nice cheekbones. Hoping he'll play Mr. Vasquez. On the show, it's actually McGuire. I let Steve had to pick his last name for the series.
That's nice.
Isn't it cool? Yeah.
That's your one concession of the husband.
My parents are the O'Neills, and my husband's name is McGuire, and mine is Vasquez on the show.
Now, if you don't get to be yourself on the show,
that's going to be so weird.
Will you say, Jerry, just don't do it then? Because
I can't imagine. No, because I still produce, I co-created it, and it's story by, and I still want to be a success.
And I think you should still stand in for the makeup scenes.
I think so.
We got to get the lighting right on this.
Yeah,
let me take this, make sure I got the right feel for this scene.
Exactly. All of that has to happen. Hey, before I go, because you have to take a break. I've done some. We have an event at Knife and Tine coming up on the 13th on Sunday. We're doing Drink Like the Dickens. And they're going to have Adam Selzer has coordinated this with Knife and Tine to make 5 drinks that are from Charles Dickens.
Will there be hot toddies?
I'm guessing. Well, we just had the mulled wine just a little bit ago.
Oh, my God.
How about Glug?
I'm sure. Well, this is kind of like Glug. It had a cinnamon stick and
some. Wait, what's the famous mulled wine? Oh, Clarence says mulled wine.
Yeah. So we're going to have some really wonderful cocktails and food, and that's on the 13th of December at Knife and Tine. You can go to their Facebook page and find out more about that.
Is that like a pre-ticket price?
Yes, it is a pre-ticket price. You can go there for more information.
And that includes a certain amount of drinks?
It includes the drinks and food and hang out with some friends and the Pretty Late Show.
Drink Like the Dickens just means you're going to drink from the time of Dickens, not you're going to drink till you're plateaued.
That's entirely up to you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Drink Like the Dickens, Knife and Tine on December 13th. Where do you go for more?
Well, you can go to their Facebook page, Knife and Tine. Go to their website, knifeandtine.com. And,
where's Knife and Tine at?
1417 West Fullerton Avenue.
Cool.
Yes. Thank you very much for letting me hang out.
Thank you, Patricia. Enjoy your week off.
I'm eating my chocolate and,
stay out of trouble.
And then go do some CrossFit so I can stay in shape. Mm-hmm. God. What were you going to say? I'm taking an Airbnb.
Have fun. You're going to L.A. Mm-hmm. Working hard. When do we know? When do we know?
May.
That's when we'll know.
May.
But you shoot a pilot first and then they look at it?
A presentation, yep. Mm-hmm. I know, it's pretty crazy. They just ordered the script yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Is the script done? Or they just place the order like, okay, now you get to make the script?
We did an 8-page outline. So every scene is plotted out. We told them what's going to happen in every scene, some of the lines. Griffin is going to be, if they cast this well and we get to do this, he's the next Alex P. Keaton on television.
Oh, that's this cool.
Super cool character. Yeah.
Now, are you just creating then just one script?
Mm-hmm.
And then, we have a lot of that.
Yeah, it all hinges on that. But I mean, like, that defines who I am as a character. I mean, this is really on me. It's really about the kind of take I have on the world. It's about my dad's medications going up in price from $5 a month to $50 a month. I think it's actually $50 to $500 a month.
I was going to say you're going to have to go bigger to stay current.
We did. Yeah, we did. So it's $50
to $84,000 a pill.
Well, and that happened over the summer, and it's my reaction to that is to kind of go a little bit Lucille Ball on the pharmaceutical company.
So it's interesting. So are you guys looking at a different, like, are you looking at the first episode of different famous shows to, like, see what they did, how they set things up?
No, they didn't.
Are you trying to set things up, or are you saying,
this is what Patty would do? It's all what would
Patty
do.
Let's just get
do.
In, like, yeah. Like, I wonder if you look at it as, okay, we have to introduce everything, or let's just pretend we're 10 shows in and just do
a show. It's that one. It's really it's funny because the first idea that we had, they said wasn't big enough. They didn't think that, they really wanted to see what my reaction would be. And I created this one. That was my idea. It was the my dad's medications. And it's kind of cool because it's a very strong father-daughter episode. And my father passed away in 2001, so I kind of get to have, it's a really beautiful love letter to my dad.
That's neat.
Yeah. So fighting for my dad and for everybody's dad.
No, it's going to be crazy. So you're going to write this. It's about your dad and it's all heartfelt. And then you're going to get all these notes.
Yeah. I know. And the notes have been great so far. They've been very positive. My writing partner said they were some of the best notes she's gotten. She's been a writer for many years. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it.
Fingers are all crossed around here, Patty.
I'm crossing a lot of stuff. Thank you, Matt Babala.
Have fun next week. Stay out of trouble and don't be fooling around the Airbnb.
I'm not making any promises.
Okay, good. I'm just saying. We got to take a break because now Patty's making me late. It's two shows she makes late here. Oh, my God. Hold on. 720 WGN. The Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. Roger, you did a news report earlier tonight about Chirac.
Oops. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I was hearing it on the way
in. I feel guilty. Yes.
Why?
I don't know. I was just born that way.
Okay. and you said, oh God, what was it? Some moviegoers liked it.
Yeah, and some didn't.
And some said, but you had like a sentence that they said.
Oh,
like,
hold on a second. Let me get it. I'll get it. That was at when you were coming in, so that was about 1 o'clock. Okay. Moviegoers had mixed reactions to the film. Some said they could relate, while others thought it was silly and stupid.
Silly and stupid, and that's very interesting to me because if you think about the state of murders in our country, it is silly and stupid. I think a lot of people are upset with Spike Lee. I haven't seen the movie yet. I only saw the trailer. Yeah. So I can't speak to it that directly. But you can see from the trailer that it is way over the top, and it's kind of crazy.
And I think that's what the silly and stupid was referring to. Maybe not the subject matter.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
However, I think he's making, without seeing it, I would defend it a little bit in that he's making a farce out of it because it's become a farce. The state of, and I know he's dealing with the South Side of Chicago, but we have 9-year-old boys getting killed. We have people getting slaughtered in massacres.
Even younger than 9 years old.
Okay, I'm thinking of Tyshawn Lee. But
right, I understand.
But I mean, that's the youngest I know of that was specifically targeted.
People get killed all the time by
stray gun fire or all sorts of craziness.
Yes.
But the fact that we don't get more upset to make change is silly and stupid. I mean, it's amazing that we've accepted these things. People talk about gun control a lot, and somebody said, you know, gun control is done in America. Once we said Sandy Hook was okay, once Sandy Hook happened and we didn't change anything, we basically said that war is over. Guns are here to stay.
Yeah.
I think that that's pretty valid.
Yeah. I think when people say gun control, the NRA jumps up.
It is amazing.
And it's not necessarily that. I think the NRA jumps up and says you're not taking our guns away.
Right.
And when we say gun control, I don't think people are saying we're taking the guns away. I don't think it's that every gun that everyone owns is going to be taken away.
Right. Well, I think certain people would like that.
Yes.
And I think there's a certain segment of the population that says no, but we got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be one of those people. I believe in the Second Amendment. We have a right to own a gun. Good for us. That doesn't mean there could be no control on that.
Correct.
You're right. And there have been some interesting things written about truly looking at the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there's a little bit of a preamble to the Second. Didn't one of the justices, I've seen this on social media, one of the justices, I think, wrote a little piece about the Second Amendment. Was mm-hmm. it Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
I believe it was.
Talking about how that was set up mm-hmm. and why that was set up and how we have to look at this, as Thomas Jefferson called it, a living, breathing document
mm-hmm.
that changes and gets adjusted. And we have to look at the time. And, you know, we didn't have a fully funded army, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a state run, we had militias. We had to be able to defend ourselves and our country.
Right.
But even if you say, no, I think it's so I can defend myself, or I have to defend myself from my government sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, take it like that. But the idea that that means anything is okay is appalling to me, that people are legally, I mean, a lot of these mass shootings, guns are illegally being purchased, right?
Correct.
And so the one side says, so we need the law-abiding people to be armed so we can defend from this. We can't take away guns from the law-abiding people because then the criminals will find ways to get the guns anyways. Okay, well, how about we just don't have AK-47s? Or how about we don't have anything that can fire 3 bullets in a second or 2 seconds. I mean, that's what's stunning to me, is that you want to defend your home, you want a handgun, you want a shotgun. I'm fine with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should have stricter regulations on how you purchase them and background checks and all of those things.
How many you're allowed to have, who in the house is registered for it, whether they can fire steel-piercing bullets.
The bullets should be changed.
Like, oh, yeah.
Absolutely. The bullets should be changed. And I think the real danger, or the bigger danger, is how quickly ammunition can be fired.
Correct.
Because that's why they're able to get through so many people in the time before it's going to take first responders to arrive.
You know, there was, I hate to say this, but I used to work for a guy long time ago who was a gun nut. And when I say nut, I don't mean in a good way.
Okay.
And he would take staff members to a shooting range, an indoor shooting range.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the one time I went to see what the heck was going on, there was a sign that said, no automatic weapons. You are not allowed to be in that shooting range, whatever they call it, with an automatic weapon. You couldn't use one. And the guy pulls one out and fires away. And the owners came running in and kicked him out. But they didn't report it. Why do you have an automatic weapon? Why do you have to fire?
But that's legal, right? I mean,
well,
it's not
illegal. It is legal. They just had the rule at the range.
Right.
You weren't allowed to use it. But it was legal. Of course it was legal. But why? What do I have to shoot at in rapid fire? I don't know how many bullets in a clip. I don't know how fast the bullets come out. I honestly don't.
Here's the defense that I think somebody like that would use.
What?
If I'm in a situation where 3 people come in mm-hmm. shooting, I'm going to be prepared to take them out. And my 6-bullet pistol mm-hmm. might not do the trick. So I'm ready if I have to be. People can come up with all sorts of reasons, I think, to defend their position on that. And that's fine.
I understand that.
But I think you're right in essence. If we took all of that away,
mm-hmm.
now, that doesn't mean they're not going to still be out there. Some criminals going to get one.
Sure.
But if we make it a lot harder, I mean, the guns in San Bernardino, I believe, all legally purchased, correct?
All legally purchased, yeah.
And
even the assault rifles.
And I saw an interview President Obama did last week, and I know people are, you know, all over the place on him, but
mm-hmm.
he did say, and I believe this to be true, that he's like, hey, we've got people on no-fly lists. Think about this, Americans.
Mm-hmm.
There's people in America who are not allowed to get on an airplane, that live here legally, that we don't allow on an airplane because we're nervous about them.
Mm-hmm.
However, they can legally go buy whatever guns they want.
Exactly.
That
who needs an airplane?
Is ridiculous.
Yeah.
To think about that.
It's very scaring. I'm a tad older than you are. And I got to say,
that's
growing up as a kid, we didn't worry about this stuff. Well, we knew there were shootings. We knew there were shootings. We saw reports of people getting shot. We saw people reports of people shooting police. We saw reports of police shooting people. But it was not on this, and the word carnage comes to mind. It was not on this level. We knew there were wars. We knew people died. We knew sides fought against other sides. We got it. We knew that. But it was not this. My goodness, I had a report earlier about the start of the violence of the weekend. Two people dead, three injured. So far, we never heard reports like that when I was growing up. And I'm talking 50s, 1950s.
Well, and it's two separate issues, I think. I mean, the mass shootings are one thing. The south side of Chicago and what's going on with how many people are getting killed here in Chicago every weekend is different, because I don't think there's almost ever an assault rifle involved in those. And just getting guns off the streets is not going to solve everything there. That is, you know, that's on so many different levels. Poverty, drugs, lack of education, lack mm-hmm. of jobs, all sorts of things that yep. are a perfect storm that are going to need a lot of help. There's not just if we get the guns off the streets, it's all over. Gary McCarthy getting fired isn't changing what's going on
not
the South Side. Not today. There's so many things that need to happen that it's daunting and frightening and just sad. And I think that it's to a point where people just shake their heads and think, well, what can we even do about it?
And here's the other deal. The government is throwing a ton of money into that. The jobs programs, educational programs. There are billions of dollars going towards all of that in an attempt to give young people viable alternatives to crime.
And that's great.
Where are the results?
Well, Roger, that's a generational problem. That's not going to, you can't throw $1 billion at a neighborhood for 3 years and change things. I mean, if you think about that, if you're already in your 30s or wherever you're at and you have mm-hmm. young kids, all of these things, you can't suddenly go to school and change your whole life overnight. I don't believe that can happen. You can't suddenly change every single thing. You're not going to, you're still in the neighborhood. You've got your family, mm-hmm. everything. You know, it was a couple of weeks ago, the Tribune reporters did a thing about how the police don't protect people enough. When nobody would come forward and talk about what happened to Tyshawn Lee, and people weren't cooperating with the police. Mm-hmm. And there was an article about how people are scared to come forward because there's going to be retribution.
Right.
And there's only so much on a local level they can do. I mean, it's not like the movies we see where they're going to move off to Arizona with a new name and a new life.
Right.
It's, we can get you a couple $100 and move you to another neighborhood. I mean, it's not a big difference. And the thing that the story didn't get to, because they're all like, we ought to do more for these people. But they didn't address the fact that if I'm in a neighborhood, I have family in the neighborhood. And I would guess that people in that neighborhood not only have the family in their house, but other family that they grew up with. Mm-hmm. And if there's a fear of retribution, you can't move everybody I know out of here. And yeah. if they're willing to go kill a 9-year-old boy, then they're willing to make I would imagine the bad guys mm-hmm. are willing to make an example of a relative of yours if you turn
sure.
over, if you do things.
That's
so,
what they did
so,
with him.
So that's a lot tougher to say, oh, the police need to do more so these people will talk and get in front of a jury.
Right.
Well, there's only so much that can be done. If you live there and if people are willing, you know, it's like President Obama said after Paris, if people are willing to die, it's very hard to stop them. And I think that that's somewhat of the mentality of a gangbanger, too. If they're shooting 9-year-old kids, I think that they're willing to go to incredible lengths. You know what I mean? I mean, there's not a code of conduct on how this is all going to go. And we won't touch certain things. It doesn't seem like an omerta of this is what we do. And there's silence and there's mm-hmm. protection of wives and kids and things like that. It's gotten to the point that how do you protect people? How do you get people to come forward to do these things? Yeah. Now, if we could make it harder to get ammunition, harder to get guns, that's certainly at least a first step. But the billions
of
dollars are going
it.
To take
yeah.
25 years to really change how people are able to grow up yeah. and get people jobs, get people opportunities to get out of the life that they're born into and the cycle we get stuck into. Lynn's on 720. You know, I got to take a quick break. Lynn, we'll get to you right after the break. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you, Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN, talking a little bit about guns in America and about all the killings and mass killings and everything else that's been going on. Lynn's got a comment here on 720 WGN. Good morning, Lynn.
Hi.
How are you?
Thank you for having this discussion.
You're welcome.
But I wanted to agree with you about the ammunition limitation. We won't get rid of all the guns, but couldn't we limit the amount of ammunition people are allowed to buy? Like the large magazines
right.
and the, you know.
Right. You know what? 630 just texted, clarifying what you just discussed. San Bernardino rifles were legally bought, but by someone else, and were illegally modified to hold high-capacity magazines and shoot fully automatic. Fully automatic has been illegal since the 1980s. No gun laws could have stopped that. Well, that's interesting, and that's a good point. However, I think they were all also using, I thought I heard, ammunition, you know, Kevlar-piercing ammunition. That should be illegal. That shouldn't be able to be purchased. I don't think that would be easy to just modify to turn it into something that dangerous. Maybe it would be. Maybe there's hacks around everything. I don't know. But I think you're right, Lynn. I think that's at least one place to start. There have been proposals in the past to tax the crap out of ammunition and make it incredibly expensive. There's a proposal, I think, in I don't know if it's in Missouri or where it is. I thought this was interesting. A legislator is trying to impose the exact same measures to buy a gun as you have to get an abortion. So waiting periods, all sorts of loopholes to jump through if you want to get an abortion. Do the same thing for people trying to buy a gun. That's maybe mixing arguments, but I thought that was interesting that it's in some places a million times more easy to get a gun than it is to get an abortion. What do you say, Lynn?
I just say that we probably won't get rid of the guns, but I thought they said that when they went in the apartment of those people that killed in
San Bernardino.
Bernardino, mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, that they had tons of ammunition in
thousands
there.
Thousands of rounds. I think, Roger, didn't they have something like 3,000 rounds still?
Yeah, not only rounds, but they had pipe bombs, too.
12 pipe bombs,
yeah.
3,000 rounds of ammunition. Could have been a lot worse. Lynn, thank you so much for the phone call. I really appreciate you staying up with us. 312-981-7200. You can call or text us here at 720 WGN. So later in the show, we're going to do this at 4 a.m. Todd Morris is going to join us. And Shanta and I were talking about this today, and it's so ridiculous that we're even going to have this conversation, but it's actually a legitimate conversation. Todd Morris is with Brickhouse Security, and he's going to talk to us about what do you do if you're in a mass shooting. The fact that we're thinking about that, and I think it's not stupid to have that conversation. In the past, I would have said, well, that's kind of pandering. Maybe that's just dumb, or we're throwing water on the fire. But I guess oil on the fire would be what I'm referring to.
Then let me ask you, because this kind of, when you said that, and you said, why are we even having this conversation, a thought popped into my mind. Mm-hmm. When we were very, very young, we had bomb drills in grade school.
Right.
We were told to either duck under the desk or go out by our lockers in the hallway and curl up. Unbeknownst to us as little kids at that time, neither of those actions would have protected us against a nuclear bomb, which is what they were telling us to be ready for. So, but you know, we shouldn't have been having that conversation.
No, but at the time, that was a real possibility, right?
Right. And nowadays?
This is. I mean, you know, there have been more mass shootings in the U.S. I think it's counted by four people shot or more in an instance. If you go by that count, I believe it is, we've had more mass shootings in the U.S. than days in the calendar year in 2015.
Exactly.
That's
scary.
Ridiculously amazing.
Yeah.
So we don't see San Bernardino that often, but it seems like at least once a year we're hearing about that. And now with this in Paris within a couple of weeks of each other and the growing threat and worry and our 24-hour news days, the worry is not going to cease because we're so aware of what's going on in the world, whereas we weren't 20, 30 years ago. We'd see it in the paper the next day or maybe on the news at 10:30, right? So now we're really going to think about these things. I saw an ad today on social media for some sort of Kevlar blanket.
I saw the picture.
To lay down. And they showed a picture like our old tornado drills where we'd get in the hallway with the book over our heads. Mm-hmm. These kids are laying on the ground in the hallway with this Kevlar blanket over them.
Yeah.
Which I would say, let's not put all the kids in the hallway where the gunman can easily go. Let's keep them, you know, huddled somewhere. We'll ask Todd about that as well. But it is the type of thing that we have to start thinking about. You know, that I will be thinking, I haven't been like this personally since 2001, since after 9/11. When in the weeks after 9/11, every time I drove downtown and I saw a plane, I was thinking, mm-hmm. oh my God, that's headed for the Hancock. That's headed for the Sears Tower. And for a few weeks, I was a wreck about that stuff. And eventually that faded. But right now I'm at the spot where if I was going to some big event, and the scary thing is the things that happen in America so far haven't ever been at a big event. They're at a workplace or at a school or mm-hmm. somewhere else. And I don't know how you completely stop something like that from happening. That's the scary part, is if some idiot gets it in their head, like President Obama said, if somebody is willing to die, it's very hard to stop them.
True.
And there's no easy way to do that. And it's amazing to me that on the one hand, we're so upset about how much we are monitored in the U.S., that they're listening to our phone calls, that the NSA is doing all these things.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we're not. Are we not doing that to all the people we're worried about at all? I hope we are. You know, if people, they're talking about these agents that are listening in on their ex-wives and their girlfriends and boyfriends. Well, I would think that anybody that they're concerned about at all, they're listening in on as well. Maybe that's why this hasn't happened earlier. But you're going to have rogue people who can legally get this stuff relatively easily. And I don't know how we're going to change that.
And here's my other concern about that. This couple was not on anyone's radar. Nowhere were they on anyone's radar. How do they amass these weapons, ammunition, and make these pipe bombs, and nobody thought to raise a red flag?
Well, I mean, how well is that monitored, though? If I go buy ammunition, is there some database? Should there be? The NRA would fight against that. They're not going to want the government keeping tabs on Americans like that. And in some ways, I agree. We don't want the government knowing every single little thing we're doing. But maybe there's certain things that we do have to register for and do have to sign in that I bought this and this is why I use it. Maybe if we, you know, it drives me crazy because it's the same thing to me and with the whole pro-life, pro-choice movement.
Mm-hmm.
And as a Catholic, it drives me crazy that, you know, we don't want abortions, right? We don't want abortions. I personally, I don't want people having abortions. Mm-hmm. I want women to have the choice, though. I don't want to make that decision for them. I want us to create a culture where people aren't having abortions in the incredible numbers that we do. The numbers are staggering how many abortions there are in the U.S. every year. But at the same time, while my faith is trying to fight against that, we're also not providing any alternative other than, hey, don't have sex, which is so freaking unrealistic. It drives me insane. If we would be willing to promote birth control and all these other things that could prevent all of those abortions from happening, at least a huge percentage, and really push that instead of just pushing abstinence as if every teenager is like, okay, you're right, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I was a teenager. Life isn't like that. We have to adapt to the times. Just like I want us to adapt to the times with our Constitution, faith has to do that too. And we're so largely driven by faith, and our separation of church and state has gotten so muddied, it drives me insane. And I don't know. All right.
Take a breath.
The calls that are coming in. I do have a guest coming up about life on other planets, and maybe that's just the trip we need. So we can get back to your calls later in the show. I appreciate you calling in right now. We'll chat about it again. But Jason Steffen from the Kepler Project is up next. Kepler, you know, is searching for life on other planets. Jason had an interesting theory he just presented in Hawaii. We'll chat with him right here. Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. All right, now for something completely different. Let's go to planets where nobody is shooting anybody. For now, till we can get our hands on them and change that. Jason Steffen is a UNLV astrophysicist, and you're in Hawaii right now, aren't you?
Hawaii right now, at least till tomorrow.
So everybody who didn't think growing up to be an astrophysicist would be all wine and cheese, Jason has been presenting in Hawaii this past week. Well, isn't that nice?
Yeah, it has been pretty nice, especially given what I just heard about your weather report.
Yeah, and you recently moved to Vegas. You're now an astrophysicist at UNLV, so you're not going to have to endure the Chicago winter, but you moved right before summer, I want to say. How was the Vegas summer?
It was great. We showed up in July, July 2nd, and went through 2 cases of bottled water and a case of Gatorade unloading the van or the truck.
I'll bet. Was that a bit of a culture shock to get out there and be in the oppressive heat? Because I know they say, oh, it's a dry heat, but I've been to Vegas in the summer, and it's not that dry of a heat anymore. There's actually a decent amount of humidity now in Vegas, and it's pretty stifling.
Well, once you get above like 110, it's hot kind of no matter what.
So that's how you look at it? 115, 110, yeah. What's the difference?
It's pretty much all the same. It'll you dry out fairly quickly. On the bright side, at least your clothes don't get soaking wet.
So you really don't sweat that bad in that heat?
But it dries very quickly as you sweat.
You sweat, but then it's so hot that it's drying. Okay, well, way to look at the bright side, Jason. So you're out in Hawaii right now presenting on a paper on a study that you've done with one of your partners on the Kepler mission, talking about how this is fascinating to me because you and I have talked many times over the past couple of years. I always bug you to promise me that we'll find life. You never come through on that promise. You never even are willing to make me a promise that in our lifetime we'll figure it out. But you're still there looking. But now you're looking at, this is fascinating because it's different, that in some systems there are two planets that are relatively close to each other. And you're looking at the idea of if those were habitable planets, that they could maybe help each other sustain life.
Yeah, so there are a lot of planets. Now, we haven't actually seen anything, to my knowledge, that would qualify from the Kepler data, but there are planets in the Kepler data that are orbiting much closer to the sun than the habitable zone. But they are orbiting very close together, where their orbital distances differ by only, you know, like 10% or so. And so if you stretch those systems out so that they were in the habitable zone, then both planets would be well inside of it. So it's not much of a stretch to then say, well, if they were both habitable, what other kinds of effects might there be going on in this system that we don't see in our own solar system?
So you've found planets that are kind of close together, but none that are Earth-like planets, none that are far enough away and close enough to really sustain life in the way that Earth can, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we see some that may be habitable, and we see some that are close together, but the two, we haven't seen anywhere both of those situations exist at the same time.
So if
Kepler sensitivity runs out right at that edge, and so, so there's probably tens of millions of these kinds of systems that are out there. We just haven't seen them.
You just didn't have time to get to all tens of millions yet. So if you did find two habitable Earth-like planets hovering somewhat near each other, like this is looking at. And what's the distance we're talking about? About 40 times the distance from Earth, say, that the moon is. If we're looking at these two planets, if you found them, it'd be about 40 times. So if we looked up in the night sky, because the moon is rather small compared to Earth, right? If there was an Earth-like planet 40 times as far away from us as the moon is, how would we see it in the night sky? Would it just be a large, bright dot, or would we actually sort of say, hey, with the naked eye, wow, that's a planet?
You definitely would be able to tell that it was a planet. You could probably, on a clear night, be able to see land featured like continents and oceans and things like that, or clouds.
With the naked eye?
Yeah.
How cool would that be? I know we're never going to see any of this, so it's, you know, silly to think about, but how cool would that be?
Pretty gnarly thought. I mean, I put together an image of, like, here's what the full moon would look like, and here's what this planet would look like. It would be about one-tenth the diameter of the full moon, but that's something that's easily resolved with the naked eye. And with binoculars, you know, you could see everything.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, that would be. So now, how would two planets like that help each other in some ways sustain life?
Well, the issues that we started investigating, they've been floated for our own solar system. We looked at two things in particular. One of them is the issue with the Earth, that if the spin axis of the Earth were to flop around a lot, it would cause fairly dramatic changes in the Earth's climate. For example, so the Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees from its orbital plane, and that's what gives us the seasons. If the Earth were closer to straight up and down in the orbital planes, then it's likely that there would be a lot more ice, like we'd be basically in an ice age, because the ice wouldn't be melting over the course of the year. Mm. And so the Earth's tilt is important in our climate. And so if you bring two planets close together, we were wondering, would those planets start affecting each other's spin axis so that the tilt changes on them? It turns out that they don't. They don't affect each other's spin axes in any dramatic way. And that's a good thing. It means if you did have these multi-habitable systems, the climate wouldn't be any worse than it is in Chicago in the wintertime. You know, it wouldn't cause any large deviations in the climate over the course of, you know, human civilization. The other thing we looked at has also, it's another thing that's been investigated in our own solar system, and that's the possibility that life may have originated on Mars, which would have cooled faster than the Earth and would have been habitable earlier than the Earth was habitable. And if life originated on Mars, it could have been transported to the Earth through the collisions of like an asteroid hitting Mars, knocking off a chunk of material that had some biological information on it. That travels through space, lands on the Earth, and then it seeds life on the Earth. So it's a process called lithopanspermia, which is a fancy way of saying collision ejecta that goes from one planet and lands on the other.
That's fascinating.
So we investigated that in these kinds of solar systems. And it turns out that it's quite a bit easier, because the planets are so much closer together, they present kind of a larger profile. And it's easier to transfer the material from one planet to the other. Which means if you had two planets that were sharing microbial life, you know, biological information between each other, if there was some catastrophic event that sterilized or killed off a lot of life on one of the surfaces, it may be able to be reseeded through this collision ejecta from the other. So the planets could kind of help each other navigate through the rough times that can occur when there's, you know, the collisions like what killed off the dinosaurs or something like that.
We're speaking with Jason Steffen. He's a UNLV astrophysicist and part of the Kepler mission. When we come back, I want to ask him a little bit more about life on other planets and what he thinks we're going to find as he continues his work. Matt Bubala with you here, Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with our old friend Jason Steffen, UNLV astrophysicist and man about the Kepler mission to find life on other planets. Or actually, is that really the mission, or is the mission only to find planets that could be habitable?
The latter. It's a mission to find habitable zones or habitable planets.
And you've done that. You've found, right? You've found a bunch of habitable planets, but we haven't found an Earth twin yet, correct?
I think that's fair to say, yes. There are a number of planets, somewhere between 50 and 100 or so, that are in what you would consider the habitable zone of their host stars. But we've not yet found one that's the size of the Earth in that zone.
That's right. We found some that are Earth-like, but like Jupiter-sized, right? Something along those lines?
Yeah, so we found big planets in the habitable zone. We've found small planets that are too close to the star, and where the two coincide, having an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone, it's going to have to wait for another mission because Kepler's not pointing in that same direction anymore.
Hmm. Where's Kepler pointing?
About a couple years ago, it's one of the gyros or the reaction wheels that helps point it and helps stabilize the pointing failed, and the spare failed. And so they had to point the spacecraft in a different direction so that they could control the its attitude or the orientation of the spacecraft a little bit better.
So is it taking pictures of another part of deep space now, or do you need it to? So what does that mean, that you just have the data you have and that'll be as far as you get? Or what is it? What is the spacecraft doing now?
So in the original Kepler field of view, it's a up in the constellation of Cygnus, we got 4 years of data, and that's all that we're going to get in that. Right now, the rest of the spacecraft, the camera and the mirror and all that, work just fine. It's just the ability to point precisely in that particular direction that's the problem. And so now it's operating as a new mission called the K2 mission, where it's pointing at different locations, basically along the orbit of the Earth, also looking for planets and other astrophysics in those different fields of view. So it'll look at a place for about 3 months, and then it will change to another place and look for 3 months and work its way around.
So in the 4 years of data that you did get, about how many stars' data can you go through now to try to figure out what the planets are around that star and their properties?
So I think on the whole, it looked at about 190,000 separate stars, and took pictures of them, you know, basically took an image of how bright that star is every half an hour over the course of the 4 years.
So wait, this machine was able to take pictures of 190,000 stars every half hour for 4 years?
Yeah.
Dude, that's pretty good.
A lot of pictures.
No wonder it went out. Yeah, thank God we're all digital now, not processing all those on film, huh? Can you imagine you pull
now
up to
it takes
to
a while.
A one-hour photo map?
So they have all these series of pictures, and it takes months for some of the largest computers in the world to process all the data.
I would imagine. So you get the data from 190,000. Is a computer going through and saying, okay, look at these because we found anomalies? Or is it just now we have photos on your desktop and you're looking at a monitor and looking at, you know, the photos by hand, like one person looking at them every time? Or how does the data then get disseminated?
So the truth is that there's a little bit of both. In the past, so there's still a lot of refinements to the analysis that are going on. So even though there's not new data, we're still making new discoveries because the data hasn't been analyzed entirely. In the past, they would identify individual signatures, and then a human would go in and look at them and say, okay, this is something we want to follow up on, and they would construct the catalog of planet candidates from that. The newest version of what's called the Kepler pipeline, it's a software pipeline where you shove raw data in and you get information back out, is doing virtually all of the vetting through software. It knows what to look for, where there's like glitches in the camera or where there's it might be an eclipsing binary star instead of a planet. So most of the Kepler pipeline is fully automated at this point, but there's still some citizen science stuff that's going on. There's a planethunters.org. It's a public website where anyone can go on and it will show Kepler data and you flag it as interesting or not interesting.
So you're crowdsourcing it. People can jump in and help out too.
Yeah, it's basically kind of like SETI at home, except it's even more interactive.
Yeah.
Where you can go and see these things. And that process has discovered a handful of planets in addition to the ones that Kepler's found.
That's cool. So of 190,000, how long is it going to take to get through all of them? When do you think you guys go, okay, 190,000, we figured out what's out there?
We have a fairly good idea of what Kepler's going to find now. We've analyzed all of the data using some of the older software. Mm-hmm. So it has all been analyzed. It just hasn't been all analyzed with all the bells and whistles that have been or improvements that have been made to the software over the last year or so.
So out of
the current schedule is that it's going to be about one more year to finish changing the pipeline, run it on the data, and then run the computer vetting of the different things to produce the catalog then it's going to be up to the other scientists to take that catalog. And this is more what I do, is I take that catalog and I look at what we see there and try to understand more about planets and the Earth and the solar system.
So, Jason, and we got to go. I'm going to be late for the news here. But 190,000 separate stars Kepler has looked at, and only 50 to 100 planets in a habitable zone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important to remember that Kepler only sees a planet when that planet passes right in front of the star. And so the probability of any planet transiting the star at the distance of the Earth is like 0.5% or so. And so of the 190,000, only 0.5% would have planets that transit. Not all of those are going to be Earth-sized, and not all of them are going to be in the habitable zone.
Mamma mia. Well, there's, and the funny thing, so this is just within our galaxy, and this is you looking at, so 190,000 stars you've looked at, that's what percent of the stars in our galaxy?
It's about 0.1%. there are 300 billion stars in the galaxy. So it's, I lied, it's not 0.1%, it's 0.00001%.
So you still got some work to do. So we need to get you a new spacecraft is what you're saying too, aren't you?
That would be great, actually, if you... Have a new spacecraft that that you can fund.
Well,
now, there is a new spacecraft that's scheduled to launch in a couple of years. That's kind of a successor to Kepler.
How much does that cost?
It's actually quite a bit smaller than Kepler. So Kepler was about $700 million for the whole mission.
That's a chunk.
This one that's flying. Well, it's a chunk. It's about something like half a day in Iraq. During the Iraq War, so
that's, a way to look at it. You're right. Okay.
So I mean, $1 billion is kind of the standard unit in the federal budget, and it's less than that. This one that's going to be launching in a couple of years is the test mission, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite,
mm-hmm.
and that's a mission that is it's about $200 million. It's a smaller mission. That will operate for a 2-year nominal mission, and then it has the capacity to operate beyond that.
Yeah. Jason, it's fascinating. I've got to go, but we'll have you back again soon. Now that you're out at UNLV, the time difference is really good for us having you on the show. So have safe travels back from Hawaii. Enjoy your time there. Don't be wooing all the ladies with your astrophysicist jokes.
It's always a problem.
I imagine it's hard to keep them away. Jason Steffen from UNLV, thanks so much for being with us, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again soon. I love talking to him. He's going to find something. He's got to find something. He's going to find something. It's the Matt Bubala Show here on Radio 720 WGN. Do you have a millennial at home? Maybe living in your basement, one that's about to head into the workforce, or are you in charge of a business and in charge or have to sometimes deal with or hire millennials? I've actually heard a lot of complaining recently about millennials in the workforce. It seems to be popping up in the news all the time. Bruce Tolgan is the founder and CEO of Rainmaker Thinking. He has done a lot of work on millennials specifically in the workplace. He has a new book out called Bridging the Soft Skills Gap, and he joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Bruce, how are you?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely.
How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. And I guess I have a millennial. My oldest son is 14, and he's headed towards the workforce someday. But I know a lot of people right now in management positions and stuff with millennials, and a lot of complaining going on. So let's get into it. Tell me what the soft skills gap is.
Well, I use the term soft skills because most people understand this in contrast to hard skills, which are the technical skills. So the soft skills are all those non-technical skills, self-awareness, personal responsibility, work habits, self-presentation, people skills, critical thinking, service mindset, teamwork. These are the old-fashioned basics, they're soft skills not because they're easy, but in contrast to the hard skills, which are the technical skills. And, you know, the technical skills gap is almost becoming a household word, unlike the soft skills gap, but the soft skills gap is also growing. It's growing in plain sight, hiding below the radar.
Well, it's interesting, Bruce, when you talk about it, when you describe what those soft skills are, they're not skills we necessarily go to college for. They're skills that we learn as we grow up. And a lot of the concern with kids these days is they have so much technology and different things that are preventing them from communicating with people one-on-one or in the ways that people had to 20, 30 years ago. Is there a real issue with millennials coming into the workplace today and all these soft skills? It's kind of frightening when you think about that, you know, you've got kids coming into the workforce who don't really know how to communicate or present themselves or do these things you just expect people to know how to do because now they're 18, 19, 20 years old.
Yeah, this is the number one issue that hiring managers complain about when they talk about the new young workforce. You know, we've been tracking young people in the workplace for 22 years now, and the soft skills gap has been hiding in plain sight but growing over the 22 years that we've been studying young people in the workplace. Now it's the number one issue that hiring managers mention it. And you're right. A big part of it is because they've grown up learning how to think, learn, and communicate using handheld supercomputers. That is a big factor. It's not the only factor, but it's a very important factor driving this.
So if you've been studying kids for 22 years, so much has changed in those 22 years, right? I mean, if I go back 22 years, cell phones were really just coming into regular usage. And so then texting came later and everything else that has just accelerated. So when you compare back 22 years ago looking at the workforce to now, what's the biggest difference between the kids today and the kids that were entering the workforce 22 years ago?
Well, you know, back then the young people were Generation X, right? So Generation Xers grew up in the 1970s and into the 80s and but we were the latchkey kids, right? We were the great unsupervised generation. Today's young people, they're the great over-supervised generation. The millennials, especially the second wave millennials, those born 1990 and later, they're the most over-supervised generation in history. They've had more structure and boundaries and guidance and direction and support from their parents, teachers, and counselors. You know, nobody ever leaves them alone for a minute. So that's one of the factors that's driving the soft skills gap. You know, 12 may be the new 19, but 30 is the new 20. And so this sort of helicopter parenting on steroids is one of the factors driving this. Also, as you point out, cell phone ubiquity. You know, nowadays, young people, they grow up learning how to think, learn, and communicate using these handheld supercomputers. That's really relatively new. That's only in the last less than two decades, for sure, really in the last 10 years. And, of course, this is also an era of nonconformism. All styles are equally valid. Well, that's a little confusing when you get back to the real world. And in some ways, today's young people are the ultimate nonconformists in this era of nonconformism. You know, they see a lot of things like how one dresses and the schedule one keeps and how one communicates, that these are all just matters of personal style. And, you know, nowadays, nobody focuses on the old-fashioned basics, so young people don't learn these things from their parents, teachers, counselors. Once they get to the real world, it's a little bit startling.
It is startling. Now, you say, so this book is for managers. We're talking with Bruce Tolgan. The book is Bridging the Soft Skills Gap. You're trying to teach companies then how to acclimate to having these millennials in the workforce. You're not screaming at the millennials, hey, you got to pick it up, you got to fix this, this is wrong. You're saying, all right, managers, here's what you have to deal with, and here's how to teach them these skills. And it's
our work is with leaders and managers, and so we've been working for years with companies of all shapes and sizes, trying to help them figure out what do they need to do to attract and select the best young people. What do they need to do to get more work and better work out of every person? How do they get rid of the low performers and keep the most valuable high performers longer? So this is just one piece of the puzzle. When young people walk into the workplace, often they have these tremendous technical skills. They might be coming right out of a university or a training program. They have the latest tools and techniques and lots of energy and enthusiasm. But often they're missing a lot of the old-fashioned basics. And so what we try to help managers figure out, well, how do you teach the missing basics to today's young talent? I mean, what the young people don't need the grown-ups to teach them the technical skills. You know, they're coming in with great technical skills. What they need is help figuring out how to use their new technical skills in the real world. And often what they're missing is these things that we always took for granted, you know, how to take notes and stay organized and be on time and meet deadlines and double check and triple check and have a good attitude on the outside, even if you're not feeling it on the inside, and say please and thank you and dress appropriately and all of these things that used to be taken for granted.
We're speaking with Bruce Tolgan. If your head is exploding right now, just hold on. We're going to take a quick break. The book is Bridging the Soft Skills Gap, because I got to ask Bruce. All right. So how did companies become the babysitters that, you know, I mean, kids are supposed to be prepared to be on time and take notes. And now you have to teach them and hand them a paycheck. God, I sound like an old man on my front lawn now. We'll be right back. Matt Bubala with you. Radio 720 WGN. The Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with Bruce Tolgan, the book Bridging the Soft Skills Gap. He's the founder and CEO of Rainmaker Thinking. RainmakerThinking.com is the website. Bruce, I had to pause there because you're telling us that these companies, you're teaching companies to teach kids to take notes, to be on time, to have a good face on the outside when you're having a tough time. I mean, this sounds like insane that somebody who's giving you a paycheck then has to teach you how to behave as well. Is the economy that bad that the solution isn't just don't hire those people that don't have these skills? Isn't that how we weed them out?
Well, of course, you are quite right that employers are paying employees. You know, young people, they think like customers. And maybe when they go to their first job is the first time, hey, you're not the customer. We're paying you. We're the customer. So we have the position, because we're paying you, we can ask you to behave a certain way. But see, this may be the first time that your new young employee has faced this situation. So look, employers right now, especially in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math, think about healthcare workers, computer programmers, systems administrators, engineers, accountants. In all of these technical fields, the supply and demand curve is out of whack. There's greater demand for high-skilled, high-trained talent than there is supply. So it's very hard for employers to rule out somebody with these technical skills because they're missing the soft skills. And although, you know, you're really onto something, what managers say to me every day is, well, their parents should have taught them this. They should have learned this stuff in school. Well, what they learned in school are these critical technical skills that are in great demand. And so employers facing this challenge, they just need to build into their onboarding and up-to-speed training and performance management process some of this performance management and coaching when it comes to the old-fashioned basics. You can't take this stuff for granted anymore. Just like technical skills are very important. You know, young people get hired for their technical skills. They get fired because of their missing soft skills. And what I tell employers is, you know, instead of taking that stuff for granted, just build it into your coaching and performance management.
When you say that parents are saying or people are saying to you, the school should have taught them these things, I think the answer to that is no, you should have taught them these things right now. It's easy for me to talk. I've only got a 15-year-old. I don't have somebody in the workforce yet that people are complaining about. Maybe I will someday, but I'd like to think that my kids will know it's their responsibility to know how to do these things. It's not the school's responsibility to teach our kids to be on time or to say thank you or to all these different very minor skill sets that kids should be learning between the ages of 5 and 15. That's on the parents, isn't it? Does that go back to what you were talking about of us just, I guess, kind of coddling our kids to death right now, helicopter parenting them, over-supervising them?
Well, I think the helicopter parenting on steroids is part of this because, you know, maybe it's a reaction to the Generation X childhood where we grew up sort of less supervised, and our parents were busy in the 70s being groovy, you know? And so in the 90s, this self-esteem-based parenting, making kids feel good about themselves, we're all winners, everyone gets a trophy, all styles are equally valid. You know, this is the message that a lot of the grown-ups have been giving to young people. The millennials have grown up with this, we're all winners, all styles are equally valid. So when they get to the real world, it's a little confusing, you know, because we're not all winners. And if somebody's paying you, no, all styles are not equally valid. So, you know, I always, you know, that's the thing is I'm not blaming parents for this, but that is a big part of it, that when you grow up being told whatever you think, say, or do is great, and you always get an individual learning plan, and you know, if you don't pass the test, well, you get to take it again, and that's a little confusing when you get back to the real world.
I think it's okay for you to blame parents, quite honestly, Bruce. I mean, these skills that we're talking about, those are parent-based skills that need to be taught to kids throughout their lives. I have a friend who's a manager here in Chicago. And over the past couple of years, twice, and she was complaining to me about millennials. And over the past couple of years, there have been a couple of times where she's promoted somebody within her organization and told them, hey, we're moving you up. This is your new job. These are your new responsibilities. You're getting a better salary. Here's everything you get, da-da-da. And they were like, great, thank you so much, da-da-da. And they went back out their merry way. And twice, she got a phone call the next day. Do you know who she got a phone call from, Bruce?
Well, I'm guessing it might have been from a parent.
From a parent.
Yep.
One of them was a parent saying, I didn't get a chance yet to work with my son on negotiation skills, so I want to negotiate that salary. And the other was a father saying his daughter, you know, should have asked for more money. And she was like, I can't even, you know, confirm that this person works here because I wouldn't do that to some stranger I don't know. And B, that's something they would need to do themselves. And he said to her, well, you have created a workforce where she doesn't feel comfortable talking to you about that. And that just scares the hell out of me. God help me, I better never be that parent. But also, those kids aren't going to work their way up. I mean, that's very damaging, I think, to their career right there, that parent makes that phone call.
Yeah, well, this is happening every day, and employers tell us and managers tell us that they're hearing from the parents of their young employees. And even if the manager never hears from them, bear in mind that, you know, young people are just a text away from asking their parents for advice about all manner of things, even once they're in the workplace. To the point where they may well be inadvertently sharing confidential information. This is the most overparented generation in history. And, you know, by the way, as a result of this, many of them are like superhuman. You know, they have superpowers. And many of these parents are creating a new species of superhuman. But The flip side is they're missing, you know, some of the things we used to just take for granted, the old-fashioned basics.
So would you say they're creating superhumans? The kids and the certain skills are doing better, are amazing us with technical skills these days, just lacking in the soft skills that mean so much to an everyday business.
Yeah, I mean, I think whatever it is that the parents decided they're going to build this young person up and make him or her feel great about themselves, that was the 90s. The 2000s, I think parents thought, wow, it's not enough to make them feel like winners. We've got to give them every possible advantage, and we're going to keep doing that because it's a fiercely competitive world. There's a lot at stake. So, you know, a lot of the parents, they just, even once they get into the workplace, they're still trying to work in tandem with their kids, trying to help them get every possible advantage. And the consequence of that is that young people have those advantages. Not all 20-somethings had a very experienced, powerful advisor, you know, who was available to them that way.
Yeah.
Every step of the way. But also, as you say, of course, they've also given them exposure to resources and training and learning opportunities. But on the other hand, appreciation of context, respect for authority, a service mindset, the willingness to puzzle through a difficult problem when you don't have the answer available at the click of a computer. You know, these are some of the things that young people are lacking now.
Bruce Tolgan is the author of Bridging the Soft Skills Gap, CEO of Rainmaker Thinking. Go to rainmakerthinking.com for more information. You can find the book online. It's fascinating and scary, Bruce. I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you, Radio 720 WGN. Did Bruce scare you about hiring a millennial?
Yeah.
I just can't believe that we're at the point now where he's like, yeah, so you guys are going to have to teach him to be on time and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you. When I was teaching, I actually, the course I taught was a federally funded job training program in broadcasting. And half of what we had to teach the kids was exactly that. How to be on time, how to have a good work ethic, how to plan ahead, how to get along with people, all those kinds of things. And it was harder, I think, to teach some of that stuff than it was the actual broadcasting
stuff.
Now,
what year was this?
Oh, this was, I just retired 2 years ago. So I started teaching.
So a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I started in 90s.
So it was millennials.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just surprising to me. And I don't know, maybe I was no different. I don't remember being different. I don't remember. Listen, if I was not on time, if I was screwing up, then I wouldn't have the job, I think, was how it used to work. Now, I can't believe that it's so widespread that a company can't say, all right, well, this isn't going to work out. We're going to get somebody else. Are we that desperate for the specific skills in so many jobs that companies now, I mean, it's not like there are not people without jobs in the country, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, there's a half a percent of unemployment rate. There's still a decent amount of unemployment. You'd think there's many people looking for good jobs. And people skills are, I think, so much more of the business life than anything else. Yes, you have to know what you're doing. Yes, you have to be smart. You have to get along with people. Mm-hmm. You have to make people want to work with you to be successful.
Yeah.
And that's so much. I mean, unless you're like an astrophysicist, a doctor, something with a very specific skill set where they're going to put up with certain things. It's stunning to me that we're going to, well, we'll teach them to be on time. We'll teach them to double check their work. We'll teach them these things. And it's not the schools that need to teach it. It's us parents that need to put a little more. And I guess part of this is probably that we're overprotecting our kids so much now and taking care of them so much now and overseeing them to such a late stage in life that they're not learning to fail and learn to do better and things like that because the parents are stepping up and trying to take over and do so much for them. And, you know, maybe that goes all the way down to me not letting my kids run around until the streetlights come on like I did when I was a kid. You know?
Well, why don't you?
Because I'm scared to. I need to know where they are.
But you turned out okay.
I know, but I don't know, Roger. It's just I can't even bring myself to do it. I can't, you know, we their kids get out, they ride their bikes, they do stuff, but my parents had no idea where I was and what I was doing for long stretches of time.
And they had faith in you. They had confidence in you that you would know better.
I don't
think
they did. I think it was just a different style of parenting where that's what you did. I don't think it's, you know, we know you're out there making the right choices. I wasn't always out there making the right choices. They should have probably had a better eye on me at times.
You now, think so? Really?
Yes. Now, I turned
but
out.
But did you learn from that?
I'm sure I did. Yes, I'm sure I did. But,
okay.
But I don't think that means parents today are completely wrong. I do think the pendulum has swung way too far to the wrong side. But, all right, a couple of calls coming in on this. Steve is on 720 WGN. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, my older brother is 52, and he's worked for Macintosh/Apple since he got out of college, and he has the same thing as millennials, but my nephew's 20, and he's already been through 3 jobs and dropped out of 1 college because he's content with his iPad and blah, blah, blah.
So he's lost the 3 jobs, like been let go because, or he just moves on to other things?
I just decided if he didn't want to show up, he wouldn't show up.
Well, I guess so.
The whole interview just struck that chord with me.
Well, so he's a young kid, and he doesn't have much he cares about right now, so he's just doing what he wants, and if he doesn't want to go to work, he figures I'll find another job?
Yeah, and as long as my brother keeps tossing him money, he...
Ah, so there's the rub, is your brother is coddling him too much and letting him get away with this. Interesting. Steve, that must drive you crazy. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get a link to the interview up on the website. Make sure you check WGNradio.com tomorrow, and you can send that along to your brother, okay?
All right, thanks.
All right, Steve, thanks so much for calling in. That's the thing is, it's okay to be fired from a job. You learn from that.
Right.
It's not okay if the parents are protecting you the whole time or you're just not bothering to show up. You know, you make mistakes, you screw up, you take risks, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But parents overseeing the kids a little too much. Lisa, you're on 720 WGN. How are you?
Hey, Matt, it's Lisa. Listen, you know, I was listening to this conversation and cringing inside. I have 3 teenagers, a senior, a sophomore, and a freshman at this time.
Whew.
And exactly. and you're just starting this journey.
I am.
You are. But I have to tell you, I'm not a perfect parent. But the one thing that I have always tried to instill in my children is to take responsibility for themselves. That was blown out of the water the first time one of my kids came home and said, I only got an 80 on my test, which is, you know, a B. But it's okay. I've got test correction, so I can probably get an A. Have you run into this?
Well, yeah. I mean, some teachers do that. I think, I don't know if I'm upset about that because I think that teachers want, you know, they do want the kids to succeed. That's what I found with Jackie's freshman year in high school. There are some classes, some honors classes or harder classes where, you know, they'll give them a chance to make up a certain portion on like homework and stuff like that. If it's something that everybody's struggling with or things like that, because their theory is now, Lisa, this could go 2 ways. One is, oh, well, that's not very tough on them. Then they need to learn that if you don't get it right, you don't get it right. On the other hand, if it's say something like geometry and it's something that you have to learn. It's not just I failed and now you have to keep moving on and you're going to fall so far behind you never catch up. You know what I mean? So if the teacher's like, listen, fix it because I want you to get it right because you got to know this stuff. It's more important.
But I don't think they should get the grade credit for it. Sure, make them responsible for fixing it and getting it right and going back over it and maybe get a little bit of extra homework credit for it. But they're actually getting full tests. Credit for it.
So they can retake the test, fix everything wrong, and still get 100% A.
Exactly. And this is not, I mean, I've got kids in AP and in honors classes, but this is just the general way it is at my kids' school, at their high school. I mean, this goes to, you know, a basic English class or an AP US history class.
Yeah, that seems crazy. That seems crazy.
Well, it really does because, you know, it's not teaching them the responsibility. You get the studying done before the test. because for so many of these kids, I really think, Matt, that they're like, eh, you know, I'm not going to study that much, but I know my teacher will give me the opportunity to do test corrections. I'll make it up later.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless it's a situation where it's something they are learning because they get another opportunity. But you're right. That still should be a B at best. You can work your way up, sure, but you can't still get the A because you didn't get it when you took the test.
Exactly.
All right, Lisa, have a great morning. Thanks so much for calling in. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Matt Bubala with you here on Radio 720 WGN 312-981-7200. We got to take a quick break, though, and we're going to jump to something else that's a bit crazy. Todd Morris is going to join us from Brickhouse Security. Have you thought about if you were in a situation where there was a mass shooting or you were at an event where something happened that you had to suddenly get out of? It's a real thing to think about, I think, these days. Maybe it's unrealistic to think it's going to happen to you. But nobody in San Bernardino thought they were going to be involved in something like that. And sometimes these things happen. We'll talk about precautions you could take or things you should be thinking about next here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala Show here on Radio 720 WGN. Well, it's a sad reality between Paris recently and San Bernardino earlier this week. People need to know what to do in a situation if something were to happen. And while the likelihood is it's never going to happen to you, and I'm sure we could throw out stats that you're much more likely to get hit by lightning or all sorts of other things rather than be involved in some sort of mass shooting or terrorist attack, when we see about it in the news, almost every single day, we start to worry about these things, whether it's Sandy Hook in schools or San Bernardino in businesses or in Paris just at a concert venue and elsewhere. People, I think, are worried about how worried should I be about this and what kind of steps would I take to protect myself in such a situation. I wanted to talk about that a little bit this morning and talk about how you keep yourself safe. And I'm not talking about grab a gun and be ready to shoot. I don't think that's personally a great idea. I know there's people that do, but I'm thinking more, what do we do if we're caught in a situation like this? Do you roll over and play dead? Do you run? How much do you think about these things? Joining us on the phone right now is Todd Morris. He's the founder and CEO of Brickhouse Security. Hey, Todd, how are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, but it is the type of thing I found myself thinking about this week. Honestly, Todd, not since 9/11 have I thought this much about security in a weird way. After 9/11, every plane I saw in Chicago for the next week I thought was going to crash into a building. And then eventually that faded away and life got a little bit more back to normal. And I think we're in one of those situations again where we're hearing so much right now about mass shooting / terrorist attacks that we start worrying about things like that and what would we do. And as I'm scrolling through Facebook today in my news feed, I see an ad or a story about these bulletproof blankets for kids to get for school. And they show a picture of kids in a hallway laying down like we used to kneel down in our tornado drills. But they had these looks like sort of orangey Kevlar blankets over them. And I don't know how much of that is too crazy and how much of it is just rational thinking, because this is the world we're living in now.
For those of us in the security industry, unfortunately, we think about it all too often. It's these things happen, you know, at a rate of almost once a day somewhere in the country. So, sadly, your chances of being involved in one or being in the periphery of one or the location of where one of these events happen is actually greater than being struck by lightning, although it is not, you know, you're still certainly far more likely to be in a car accident.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But, I mean, there's, you know, what, 100 million cars on the road every day. So the odds on that are we're going to have to get pretty bad here before those odds change, I imagine. But it's in the news, and it gets a lot of attention when it happens, so we certainly think about it. So let's go to the basics on what you do in those situations. So let's go to Paris and the theater where these people marched in and started shooting people. And it's a loud music venue. It's hard to understand what's going on at first, as we saw from some of the film, people, it took a second or two to realize what was going on. I read conflicting stories about playing dead or running, different things that are getting out there now. If you're in a situation in a theater like that and something starts going awry, what should you be doing?
Well, I think the first thing is I don't want everyone to think they need to be paranoid about this all the time, but you also don't want to be in the situation where the first time you think about it is when shots are already being fired. And so just like when you move into a new home or you go to a new office, you think about where the fire exits. When you get onto an airplane, even though you've probably been on 100 747s, you always want to look where the exits are. I do think that, you know, people should be a little more conscious of their surroundings and aware of what they would do in case of a fire, a bomb, or an active shooter, and just know where they would go. How would you get out, and what route would you take, and if that route was blocked, what's your alternate route, and where would you gather with your family? And, you know, I actually do this with my kids, but it starts off as not something scary of, oh my gosh, there could be some maniac with a gun. It's, if we get separated for any reason, where will we meet? And I consciously pick a place to meet that would not be an unsafe location for them to be standing if there were some sort of an event. So I think it's a good practice for people to just be a little more situationally aware of, I'm going to a venue. Where are the exits? Yes, they're talking about fire exits, but they're also talking about exits and ways out. And so think about those exits. How would you get out? And talk to the people you're with. If there were a fire or any other event, or if someone just got lost, where would we meet up? And maybe we want to think about making that meetup location the parking lot across the street and not standing right out in front of the building.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense because, you know, October was Fire Prevention Month. We just kind of should have gone through this with our families. Of course, in our home, we should have had this conversation. What are the safest exits if there's a fire and where would we go? That's the big thing that I think we don't think about. And I've never done this with my kids. And all the times I've been to Soldier Field or Wrigley Field or any huge venue where somehow you could end up getting separated, especially if there was some sort of event, what would you do? Where would you go? And it makes sense. Like you said, just like when you're getting on the airplane, you still make sure where the exits are. What are the ones closest to you? You should take note of that, I would imagine, in any theater or sporting venue, and then talk to your kids, if you have kids with you, about what would we do if we got separated. And so what is the advice on that? You want it to be a safe place, but I imagine you don't want it to be the place. So at Wrigley Field, if I said, well, meet under the marquee outside, well, there's going to be 30,000 people there. So you find a place that's safe and well-lit, yet maybe it's going to be easy to find each other? Or what are the rules on that?
You're actually not necessarily looking for a place where it's easy to find each other, because if you really do just get separated, finding each other you'll be able to do in any of these locations. What you're thinking about is where is going to be a safe location that is out of the line of fire, not just of an active shooter, but if there were an explosion, if there were a fire that caused an explosion, if a SWAT team showed up to try and disarm someone, friendly fire is just as deadly as enemy fire. And so you definitely want to think about that. And as you're coming in, usually when you look at any location, you know, there are landmarks you can find, whether it's a bus stop or a generator or an area where, you know, the cars and buses park or a carport. Look for something that will be easy to find over the heads of crowds. So if there is a crowd, your kids will be able to see it and you'll be able to see it. It's not something that's marked by a small cone in the middle of the parking lot, but rather a, you know, something tall that you can see and get behind. Definitely something to think about. And you also want to think about picking that location based on who you are and who you're with. And that goes to not just understanding the situation and the location you're in, but making an honest assessment of your personal limits and strengths. So, for example, if I'm going somewhere alone or with coworkers, I might pick a safety spot that is very different than the safety spot I would pick if I was with my 7- and 5-year-old. You know, you want to pick a spot that makes sense for you. And you also want to be thinking about how you would react in a situation like this based on your own personal situation, not just who you're with, but your own personal capabilities. Some people might know that they are susceptible to panic attacks and they are not the best under pressure. And that's something to know. And just think about it ahead of time. It's always easier to deal with a situation, no matter how scary it is, if you visualize it first. Just like athletes visualize the way they'll swing the bat or catch the ball or make the play, you should visualize and think about, if I were in that situation, what would I do? And honestly, how do you think you would act? Because none of us are really Rambo. So expecting yourself to go out and do backflips off the back of a window and get to someplace safe is probably not appropriate. But some people might feel more confident being the one that is going to run and climb and get somewhere safe. Someone else might want to say, you know what, I'm the one who's going to just hide underneath a table very quietly and just tell everyone else to leave them behind and go.
Well, let's get back to that.
That's appropriate.
Let's get back to that in a minute. Todd Morris is with us. He is the CEO and founder of Brick House Security. You can find out more information at brickhousesecurity.com. So hide under a table or run like hell. That becomes the question when bullets start flying. We'll get to that next here on 720 WGN. Here with you on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with Todd Morris of Brick House Security, brickhousesecurity.com. You can follow them on Twitter at Brick House Secure. Drop the E on secure, S-E-C-U-R, at Brick House Secure with no E on the end on Twitter. So, Todd, when we were going to the break, we were talking about, well, let me jump back to the, just for a second, let me jump back to when we set up the plan to leave. You were saying how you tailor it to who you're with. So while we said, you know, not necessarily a place where nobody can find you. You got to think about getting out of the way of fire, getting out of the way of the line of fire, whatever it is. I imagine if you're with a 7-year-old versus you're with a 30-year-old, with a 30-year-old, you guys might say, hey, we'll meet 3 blocks away at this bar or at this restaurant or whatever. Just set up a place. You're all adults. You can get there. With young kids, you have to think more about how are they going to be feeling in this emergency situation and is it going to be easy for them to find that place, right?
Right. And also, how far can you run and how fast can you run if you're carrying one or both of those children?
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned, you know, the people you're with and deciding what to do. And somebody might say, you know what, I'm just hiding under this table. Go. I'm staying here. So what is the general advice when something happens, when shots start, you know, we know if there's a fire, you got to get out. You can't stay there and wait that out. But if somebody's shooting, there's a little bit of a debate over play dead or hide or just run like hell. Is there a general advice on that?
When we were growing up, we all learned stop, drop, and roll. If you're on fire, stop, drop, and roll. There is a similar mantra for active shooters, and that is run, hide, fight. The difference is you don't always do it in that order, and you don't always do all three. The first thing you want to do is exit the area as fast as possible, if possible, run. Always try to run first. There are exceptions to that. If you know that you either for physical reasons or mental reasons or the people you're with will not be able to run, then don't run. Hide. If you can only run so far and then you need to hide, hide. If you can run far enough to get the heck out of there, don't bother hiding. Keep running until you're blocks away. But definitely the first reaction is get yourself into a safe location, preferably one that's as far away as possible. But if for some reason you can't get far away, then make sure you get yourself into the safest position you can as quickly as you can. There are definitely difficult decisions to be made. If you are with a large group of people and some of them are not capable of running, the last thing you want to do is be in a large group of people. So following the crowd or trying to help slow people get out is not going to help either of you. The larger the crowd is, the larger the target is. Mm-hmm. Most of these shooters are not very effectively trained. They're not combat trained. They're taking advantage of slow-moving targets in large groups. So don't be slow-moving and don't be in a group. If that means leaving people behind, they are better off on their own under a desk than they are being slowly pulled or carried by you. You're just a bigger, slower target.
If you are left behind or you stay behind and there are victims near you, should you, I mean, and you can't find a place to hide, should you ever lay down and just try to pretend to be dead?
The only time you would ever want to lay down and pretend to be dead is if quite honestly, the shooter has already passed by that area, and there are authentically dead people near you. And that's obviously a very difficult emotional situation, but, you know, no shooter is going to walk into a room they haven't been in, see someone lying down, and think they're dead. They will just shoot you.
It's crazy that we're having these conversations and that this is a reality we're talking about. So I saw this ad today for some sort of security blanket for kids who are in a shooter situation in schools. Do you ever see a scenario where schools should actually order these things or ever have kids laying down with a bulletproof blanket over them?
So there are a lot of schools looking into what they can do to make themselves harder targets and harden the security for the kids. I don't think that a blanket is necessarily a good solution. However, a Kevlar blanket or drape that is covering a locked door, that would certainly help alleviate the fact that most of these doors have glass in them. So, having hanging hooks above a door that a teacher can hang a Kevlar sheet over to cover a door that's locked but has a glass window in it, that's not a bad idea. And there are certainly schools that are doing those types of things to outfit their classrooms so that they can be turned into a more secure bunker.
You're talking about hanging that sheet on the other side of the door where everybody's hiding? Because
on the inside of the door. What you'd want to do is lock the door where you're on the inside.
Okay.
But even though the door is locked and you and the children are on the inside, there's a glass window in some of these doors. And even though that glass may be bulletproof glass only lasts so long with high enough caliber close fire. So, if you've got something to cover that window with from the inside on your side, that would certainly protect you and the kids from breaking glass or bullets that make it through the glass.
And the
bullets that make it through the door.
Yeah, and the hope is that these gunmen then just keep moving on because they don't have time to break the door, get in there. They'll just keep moving to easier targets. At least that's your hope in that instance, right? Because if the guy wants to sit there and just shoot at the door several times, he could then probably kick it in most likely, right?
Right. Your hope is first, get out. If you can't get out, make yourself inaccessible, either because you can't be found or because it would take too long and too much effort. One of the most difficult things about these situations is it takes several minutes. It could take 2 to 12 minutes for the police to arrive, and they know that, and they want to do the most damage they can in the first 5 minutes. Because they may not have more than that. So they will probably not waste 5 minutes trying to get through one door.
So when we talk about workplace then, is it the same thing? Wherever you go to work, maybe you should think about, because it could be anything. I mean, somebody, this has happened before, where just somebody gets fired and they get mad and they come back. And maybe they're mad at one person, but you never know what they're going to do. So at work, should I know where all the exits are? Should I know what I would do if I heard gunshots, if my desk is secure, if I'd be hidden, if there's an easy exit out of back or different things like that?
Absolutely. And at work, I would say not only should you know your way out and you should know what things you can do to, get out quickly and how you can get out, but you can also think about making alterations to harden your structure and make it more difficult for someone. If you've got multiple doors, are those doors reinforced? Are there ways that you can lock off certain areas? And this can be done as part of other policy changes. So, for example, many medical facilities and retail stores are going through processes in their IT and security upgrades to make sure they are either HIPAA or credit card fraud authorization protected so that they're protecting people's data. Well, part of that same upgrade process, if you're going to put in multiple doors to seal off areas where certain people aren't allowed to go because they're sensitive, either credit card or medical information, you can take that opportunity to also make those doors stronger, more reinforced, potentially bulletproof.
I would imagine that, so many businesses, schools have just completely glass doors where there's just a wire or a metal framing around, which could easily be shot through. Like you said, even if they're bulletproof, eventually you could shoot right through them. Now, that's harder on a shooter because, like you said, they don't have that much time. They know that. And if they announce they're getting in by shooting their way in, then everybody at least is on alert. But I imagine we could also do things with those doors. Would you advise places not to put in those straight one sheet of glass doors, put in something where the handles could be a little better protected from being shot through from somebody shooting through the glass and then just walking right in, things like that?
There are some doors that, even though they're glass, they can certainly be reinforced. There are films you can get that, you know, much like when you tint a car, you can car glass, you can put this film on the glass, and that will retrofit it to make it shatterproof and bulletproof to small arms fire, not large arms fire. But yes, if you're doing original construction, I don't think anyone's building new doors onto schools now that are all glass. But there are certainly a lot of old schools, and as we know, budgets in schools are not unlimited, so they're not replacing perfectly good doors as quickly as they might want to.
Todd Morris is the CEO and founder of Brick House Security. You can find out more information at brickhousesecurity.com. Todd, I hope I don't have another reason to talk to you anytime soon, but I feel good knowing you're out there, and I'm sure we'll have reason to talk to you again.
It was good talking to you. I hope we don't have to talk about this one again.
You're listening to Matt Bubala on Radio 720 WGN.